Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben, and today I'm very glad to say my guest is Kenneth Austin. Kenneth teaches history at Bristol University in the UK, and we're talking to Kenneth today about his new book, just published by Yale University Press. It's called The Jews and the Reformation. Kenneth, congratulations on the book, and welcome to the show.
And thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you here, and I really appreciate you taking time to talk about your work. But before we do that, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I'm a historian at the University of Bristol. I've been there for about 15 years, and I teach especially Reformation history. And I think one of the big questions that I'm most interested has always been the relationship between different religious groups, both within Christianity and both in my PhD that became my first book, and then in this book, the relationship between Christianity and Judaism. So I think that's the particular strand that has motivated me through most of this period. My PhD, which I did at St. Andrews University, looked at a 16th century convert from Judaism to Christianity, Emmanuel Tremellius, somebody that went on to a prestigious career as a Hebrew scholar, academic, and translator of the Bible. And my PhD, which became my first book, was a biographical study of him, trying to understand the sorts of pressures that an individual like that was subject to, and to understand his career in the context of the 16th century. And I think with this book, I suppose I've gone from the micro of that one person study to the macro, trying to think about the same broad set of questions, but across a period of closer to 200 years and across much of Western Europe.
Now, the Tremellius book is a really tremendous book. I read it when it came out and found it extremely helpful. Your new book, The Jews and the Reformation, is in some respects, in many respects actually, a groundbreaking work. In fact, Lyndall Roper at Oxford blurbs it as saying it's a book that transforms the subject. I think that's true. Before we dive into your book particularly, could you tell us a little bit about the scholarly context in which you're working here?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's maybe at least a couple different things to say. So I think in broad terms, for a start, there's a fairly natural division in the types of history that is written. So on the one hand, there is a tendency for Christian authors, or Christian people within a Christian tradition, to be writing for Christian readers, and similarly for Jewish authors to be writing for Jewish readers. And to some extent, that thinking about the period of the Reformation and attitudes towards Jews and Judaism within that has tended to fall down those lines, so that in the historiography, there's a tendency for Jewish scholars to look at the experience of Jews almost as a separate subject, that it's sort of hived off from the main part of what Reformation scholars are thinking about. And I think sort of the long-term sort of consequence of that is that the Jewish perspective and the Jewish contribution is really neglected. And I think there are sort of understandable reasons for that. The Jews possibly sort of constitute 1% of the population of Europe, so they are a minority. But as I think I try and sort of argue in the book, they perhaps hit above their weight in various respects, not least in the Christian imagination. But I think sort of also within the Christian context, and actually even across those two categories, there have been a large number of very focused studies, either looking at, like my own book, looking at an individual, or looking at a sort of a very localized study, the Jews in Venice, for instance, the Jews in Strasbourg, and particular themes that allow for that very sort of detailed, rich, nuanced study. But what I felt was that there wasn't really enough of an effort to try and draw those various micro studies together. And I think sort of part of what I suppose I've been really trying in this book was at least to map out some of that bigger picture stuff, drawing on these different instances, but pulling together themes that are sometimes treated in rather different contexts. One of the bigger ones, for instance, I think, is to put Jews and Judaism and Jewish scholarship together. It's sort of they're distinct clearly, and they have different ramifications and significances, but in some ways at least I think they interconnect, and actually sort of drawing them together in turn actually then allows one to draw out some of the ambivalences, the ambiguities in Judeo-Christian relations. So it kind of felt necessary to try and take that bigger picture approach to try and say, actually, how do Jews and Judaism fit within this broadly Christian Reformation context across the 16th and 17th century, and at least in part to try and draw out some bigger patterns. I mean, that's still accepting that sort of there will be lots of exceptions along the way, but sort of that sort of endless series of micro studies means that sometimes that bigger picture is only touched upon as framing for those individual studies. And this is a kind of an effort perhaps to shift the balance and to look at that grander framework.
And the book is very successful in doing that. It's a big book on a big subject, isn't it? And in some ways it's framed by events which are much closer to us than the events of the Reformation. You begin the book by talking about Kristallnacht. I wonder, could you explain to us why you decided to do that, and also how you dealt with some of the other challenges of writing about this subject in the particular context in which we find ourselves?
Absolutely. And I suppose it's to appreciate that when we think about Judeo-Christian relations, even in the early modern period, that we don't do them in neutral ways, that sort of whether the legacy of the Second World War and Kristallnacht and all of that really has determined both how I think sort of the population at large, but also writers on these subjects approach the subject in the earlier period. I think there's sort of and it may be something of a double-edged sword, but I think there is a tendency to kind of try and understand how did we reach a point in the 20th century when so many Jews were killed? How can that sort of phenomenon be explained? And to some extent, that has then pushed writers to look at the development of anti-Judaism, anti-Semitism in earlier periods, to kind of chart that narrative. And I think that's an important question. It frames how we think about the subject, and it's part of then the motivation to kind of address these big important questions. I started by saying I'm interested in the sort of the relations between different religious groups, and I think there, I suppose, in sort of going back to many of the materials, actually is sort of looking for the more positive dimensions. The sort of the anti-Judaism, the anti-Semitism is perhaps the thing that has tended to dominate the historical writing on the subject, but I think that's maybe not the whole picture. So trying to bring out that more nuanced and sort of complex picture is at least part of what we're doing. At the same time, and I think it's sort of, this is the sort of the balance to be struck, this awareness of 20th century events frames how we think about it, about earlier eras. But there's a risk that we then are looking to draw undue connections or to overplay or only look for those things that sort of lead in. And I think, I mean, in sort of the specific context of this this book and these themes, it is striking the connection between Martin Luther and Kristallnacht. The fact that various figures involved in those most brutal events in the 1930s see themselves as in some ways acting out what Luther had intended. And making explicit links back. This is part of a sort of, because Luther wrote against Jews, especially in his later career, quoting his works and sort of giving new attention to what he had to say about the Jews in the 1930s. And I think sort of, again, that connection I think is really important, sort of, again, framing how we have thought about these themes in sort of more recent decades. But at the same time, I think I'm trying to acknowledge that link in order to break it. And particularly with this book, to then say the Reformation is much more than Martin Luther. Actually that his attitudes are unrepresentative of that Reformation whole, and sort of when those are the ones that we sort of most commonly encounter in this context, that's problematic for our basic understanding.
That's fascinating, Kenneth, the way you arrived at that effort to nuance and complicate Lutheran legacies as they have rolled out even to the present day. But I think one of the other things I found fascinating about your work here was not just that it had one eye to the future, but also one eye to the past. And you situate the Jews in the Reformation, or the Jewish experience of the Reformations, within a much broader continuum of Jewish-Christian relations. And you begin, don't you, in the period of the first century. So in a nutshell, What is that long history of Jewish-Christian interactions? What is this parting of the ways that you and other scholars talk about in this period?
Yeah, I suppose it's that the real complexity of what the Judeo-Christian tradition actually means. There is on the one side that sense that they are both faiths that emerge from the same crucible. That they have much in common, above all the shared religious text of what the Christians call the Old Testament. So on the one hand, that sort of real points of similarity, but at the same time, then the two traditions have separated. I mean, sometimes people talk about the parting of the ways, sometimes the sort of an effort to kind of suggest actually that whole process is something that sort of itself, maybe we've kind of made nice and neat, and sort of we have, sometimes we have that sort of sense that Christianity in quotation marks and Judaism in quotation marks are sort of things that sort of can be sort of neatly traced at that early stage. It's a bit fuzzier, but that as kind of Christianity emerges as an entity, some argue at least that Judaism, in a sense, also develops its own identity in opposition to Christianity, and to some extent, because of those similarities, actually the two then are in a process of self-definition using the other as one of their main reference points. And so, again, most obviously, the two reflect their distinct identities by augmenting the Old Testament or the Hebrew scriptures with supplementary texts, so the New Testament in the Christian tradition, the Talmud in the Judaic. And that, even in a place like the New Testament, those ambiguities continue to play out. Sort of, is the New Testament a reaction against Judaism? Is it an effort to separate away from, or is it an effort to imply a level of continuity? And in fact, I think sort of the way I read it, there's elements of both. And sort of there are many ways in which, in the New Testament, Christ is presented as the fulfillment of the promises in the Old Testament, that the two testaments need to be seen together at the same time, and sort of particularly in scenes like the Passion, the Jews are held directly responsible for Christ's death. And that sort of initial tension, I think, only becomes more pronounced. And in that first chapter, I do then try and sort of, in a sort of something of a whistle stop tour, but sort of try and think about that emerging and developing relationship between the two in the period up to the eve of the Reformation, sort of into the 15th century. And I think sort of, I suppose it's worth saying that sort of tensions are not always apparent, but they sometimes become more pronounced, particularly at times of stress. But I think sort of that ambiguity and that sort of sometimes emphasizing the distinction, sometimes acknowledging the similarities, is kind of part of what makes, I think, the sort of Judeo-Christian relationship so interesting in the first place, that it has these different levels. But it's also what makes it sort of harder to just sort of draw a neat line. In fact, again, there are these conflicting impulses that will take precedence at different times.
Well, let's stay with this idea of definitions and ambiguities, Kenneth, and let's talk about the other big buzzword in your title, which is Reformation. Now, I was fascinated to see that you begin your discussion of Reformation not, I suppose, with a kind of classic set piece of Luther and his hammer and 95 Theses and a door in 1517, but actually a generation earlier with the Spanish Reconquest, also described as a Reformation. Why did you decide to frame your discussion of Reformation in such a surprising but enlightening way?
Thanks for the question. I think there's maybe two different reasons or main things that I was thinking about there. I mean, the first, and I kind of, I suppose, I alluded to this already, was that I wanted to decenter Luther and to move away from, I mean, exactly as you say, the classic account of the Reformation starts with Martin Luther in 1517. And I think sort of both because his views on Jews are the things that have maybe received greatest attention, I was kind of keen to suggest there is a broader context. But the second and more fundamental consideration is that I suppose I'm trying to say that Martin Luther's rise and appearance on the scene is one iteration of a much broader phenomenon. That is the greater attention to religious reform, broadly understood, emerging through the Renaissance in the 15th century, and then really sort of gathering great momentum in the latter part of the 15th century and into the start of the 16th. So while we do have Luther coming out with his challenge to the Catholic Church and the 95 Theses in 1517, we have other people offering similar critiques of elements of Christianity, whether Erasmus as a humanist, pointing out some of the things that he didn't like about the Catholic Church, though still aiming and remaining within the Christian Church, within the Catholic Church. And then people in a whole range of other territories, again, asking questions about the nature of their religion. Some, like Luther, ultimately breaking from Catholicism, others remaining within it. And I think the expulsion of the Jews and as one element of the process of re-Christianizing or Christianizing of Spain by Ferdinand and Isabella is another manifestation of that same broad phenomenon, that kind of anxiety, I think, there's sort of an awareness, perhaps, or kind of renewed attention to what it is to be a good Christian, what it is to be a good Christian ruler, what it is to be a good Christian society. And I think sort of that Luther, for the ease of the narrative of the Reformation, and sort of when I'm sort of giving first year lectures, the sort of it's nice to have a figure around whom you can hang this movement and use that as an opportunity to think about the different beliefs and practices that are sort of germane to this. But actually, that is to personify a broader movement, and that kind of continent-wide re-evaluation of what it is to be a Christian, I think, is really what I see as the start of the Reformation. And sort of because, again, also because this is a book in which I'm talking about Reformations, as sort of some trendy historians do, that sort of pluralized version, Protestant and Catholic, is a sort of an effort to acknowledge that diversity. It's not that the Lutherans, for instance, have a monopoly on this. Actually, this is a sort of a whole series of religious groups all kind of conducting parallel movements of religious reform. And by moving away from Martin Luther, the kind of the natural starting point was, I think, at least in part, an attempt to signal that difference of approach.
Now, as we go into the heart of your book, Kenneth, we see you working on a canvas of, I suppose, more or less 200 years or thereabouts. And within that broad canvas, you're describing how different religious groups, some of which you've just mentioned, Catholics, Lutherans, Calvinists, even Anabaptists, who are not always included in this kind of discussion, which again I think is one of the real benefits of your work. But you're interested in showing how each of these religious groups and others are developing attitudes to or even relationships with Jews or Jewish texts, Hebrew language, even reconstructing Jewish religion in various kinds of ways. Could you tell us a little bit more about how each of those movements develop in their relationships with Jews, Jewishness, Hebrew language, and so on?
Absolutely. I suppose the broad structure, exactly as you say, sort of the middle chapters of the book. I mean, I think there's, and it's one of the issues that I really wrestled with in writing it, was exactly how to organize this material. And I think sort of there is a broad division, sort of chapter by chapter, looking at these different Christian strands, but at the same time also trying to sort of superimpose a chronological dimension to that. So when I think sort of a couple of things just by way of framing, I think part of what I want to say is that within each of these different Christian groups, there is variation. That it, again, sort of, while one might be tempted to, and I may still go on and do this in later in the answer, and sort of to sort of say this is the Lutheran position, this is the Calvinist position, and so on. But I think it is important that we acknowledge that there is the membership of those particular groups doesn't mean that there is a sort of canonical set of beliefs that one must hold. Excuse me. But also to appreciate that there are various recurrent themes that one can see being exemplified within each of these traditions as well, so that there are some of the same sorts of questions and approaches on a Catholic and a Protestant side, for instance, or on a Lutheran, on a Calvinist side. All that said, I think there are still broad patterns that one can identify, at least in part as well. I think there may be an element where those are framed by, at least, again, to some extent, by the experiences of the leaders of the movement, the respective movements, and especially where they live and how likely they are to encounter Jews in their own lives. So one of the obvious things to note is that part of the reason why Luther writes about Jews more frequently than any of the other leading Protestant figures is that actually he was living in the Holy Roman Empire, sort of living in territory where Jews were quite quite likely to be encountered in relative terms, whereas Calvin and some of the other members of the Reformed movement were far less likely to encounter Jews. And consequently, Jews as living people, people living among them, were less of an immediate issue. So for that reason, there may be sort of the way that they even thought of the issue in Jews, Judaism, differs because of that sort of fundamental context. Certainly, Luther famously starts very positively in his writing about the Jews in 1523, so only 6 years after his initial protest against the Catholic Church, and initially advocates that Christians should be more sympathetic than he thinks the Catholic Church has been to Jews, presenting a different face of Christianity, and that this will bring Jewish conversion, Jews converting to his version or his type of Christianity. When that doesn't happen, and sort of when he becomes rather more disillusioned with some of the achievements of the Reformation in the last years of his life, especially in 1543, he then writes these horrific works against the Jews and says that they can never be converted and so on. His colleagues within the Lutheran movement, as I kind of suggesting, are rather more sympathetic, and sort of a number of them sort of disavow what he has to say. But there is perhaps that sort of animosity, perhaps is maybe sharpest within the Lutheran tradition. Within the Calvinist, or more broadly the Reformed with a capital R world, there is perhaps more of a tendency to demonstrate interest in the nature of Judaism and Judaic learning. I mean, again, Lutheran scholars do this, but it seems more common amongst Calvinist scholars that they will draw perhaps more explicitly on rabbinic scholarship when they're looking at the Bible and trying to understand what is going on in different passages, for instance. And there's, I think more of a more sustained engagement, perhaps, with the Old Testament, and in order to do that, then with the Hebrew language and Jewish intellectual world more broadly. So that sort of thorough engagement with that seems perhaps most pronounced amongst the Reformed tradition, to the extent as well that sometimes that they see themselves, the Calvinists, as the new chosen people, and the sort of that kind of classic Christian idea of supersessionism, the idea that Christianity has replaced, or Christians have replaced, the Jews as God's chosen people. But I think sort of for the Calvinists, that then even manifests itself in a readiness to identify quite explicitly with the Jews of the Old Testament, even taking on names that have those overtones, so starting to calling themselves Abraham and and things like that. The radicals, I suppose, it's sort of if it's difficult to generalize about sort of these mainstream Protestant groups, for the radical groups, the various groups of Anabaptists becomes even harder because there's sort of each group has its own particular viewpoint and take. For some of them, at least, and one of the recurrent strands among the more radical sect of the Reformation, connects to Sabbatarianism and when the Sabbath is to be celebrated, and for some groups in particular, there is a perhaps a readiness both to consider moving away from the Sabbath on Sunday and to revert to biblical practice, when a lot of what the Reformation is thinking about how the Bible should be a touchstone for Christian behavior. That one of the questions is quite how much of it and how literally one follows what one encounters there. And I think sort of one of the discoveries is that the idea of Sunday worship isn't something that has sort of very clear evidence in the Bible, and so there some of these radical groups start suggesting that actually celebrating the Sabbath on the Saturday would be actually sort of more appropriate. But I think sort of by this point it's become so ingrained in Christian culture that this is sort of another step too far from the radicals. The Catholics, finally, I suppose, in this sort of very, very quick sort of sweep over the top, I think sort of for the Catholics, they have the longest history, as it were, of already thinking about how to deal with Jews, and I think sort of, but then that is informed by being in that Reformation context and an awareness that what the Protestants are doing sort of does start to shape some of their thinking on this as well. But I think sort of they're one of the fundamental questions, and I think this is true across the board, that hope that Jews will convert to Christianity at some stage. There is that, and I think sort of within the Christian, within the Catholic tradition, the Augustine in particular, 4th century church father, who talks about tolerating Jews, allowing them to live among Christians, but because they played an important part in the story of civilization, and sort of particularly within Christianity, not least that they preserved the books of the Old Testament, they now serve, as he argues, as a living witness to what happens if you fail to follow God's message. That he argues the fact that they are spread across, sort of scattered across Europe when he's and sort of further afield when he's writing is evidence of the fact that they've lost God's favor, and therefore they serve as a reminder that one should continue to act in accordance with God's will. But he says they serve an important place or role in that sort of grand scheme of things. They should be allowed to live amongst Christians, but they should be kept in a somewhat subjugated position. That becomes more complicated, and certainly sort of in the Middle Ages, some argue that that Augustine was talking about biblical Jews, those that lived in accordance with the Old Testament, whereas what they're being confronted with are Jews that now adhere to the Talmud. And these are different and therefore don't need to be treated in the same way. And this becomes a sort of a point of contention amongst sort of the Catholic leadership. But there remains a desire to bring about Jewish conversion, either through more positive means and sort of providing them the opportunity to convert should they wish. So houses of converts are established in Rome, but in various other Italian cities, for instance, places where Jews can learn about Christianity and be protected and sort of help to learn, but to be protected from the assumed harmful influence of continuing contact with their fellow Jews. So that kind of quite positive and sort of a reassurance that you won't lose your property or anything that you've got if you do convert on the one hand. Alongside that, and certainly sort of one of the strands that develops in the mid-16th century, emanating from the papacy and of the Counter-Reformation especially, is a sort of more of an effort to use threats or hardship, and that is the use especially of ghettos, and particularly ghettos had existed in some ways to sort of allow for Jewish existence alongside Christians, but sort of from the mid-1550s, ghettos are increasingly then used as a means of really forcing Jews to, or the hope is that it will force them to convert to Christianity by making their experiences as unpalatable as possible, that they are then subjected to Christian theology sermons, sometimes delivered in Hebrew, that they are forced to listen to, for instance, that they are the jobs that they can fulfill are very limited and menial in nature, that they are kind of obliged to live in this close, cramped ghetto. Their access to the key things of their religion sort of really reduced, so maximum one synagogue within that, and so on. Again, worth saying though that that emphasis on conversion through hardship is only one strand, and sort of seems especially prevalent in the second half of the 16th century, and sort of emanating from certain popes. There is a sort of again a reversion back to that more balanced set of views later on, and again that sort of that is a message that when one looks at Catholicism across the continent, one sees a rather more variable pattern, that some Catholic rulers end up being the most sympathetic to their Jews, the Jews in their territories, and the sort of series of Holy Roman Emperors, in particular, the biggest or most powerful Catholic rulers consistently act as defenders of their Jews. But as I say, I think as that hopefully indicates, at least it's a complex picture, and the book tries to sort of deal with that and more.
It's such a big subject, Kenneth, isn't it? And we really appreciate the time you've given us today coming onto the show to talk about this new book, The Jews and the Reformation, just published by Yale University Press. Thank you for your time and take care. And thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.